The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today I'll be reading a poem by Rachel Hadas, a short story by Garth Greenwell, and a review of the TV show Please Like Me. All of this from the November 26, 2018 edition of the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a poem, 460 Riverside Drive, by Rachel Hadas. We lived on the ground floor. The doorman Earl sat in the lobby. From our living room, through the wall, we could hear Earl's explosive sneezes loud and clear. The knob of our apartment's front door was big and brass, and Earl would vigorously grasp and twist it, and with rag and smelly polish noisily buff that knob until it gleamed. It always gleamed. I knew that brass polish was poison. From our side of the door, the knob would visibly turn as Earl twisted it, apparently of its own accord, untouched by human hand. Visitors didn't understand. Who was out there? What ghostly messenger was rattling away, unseen on the other side of the door? Who, sent from where, was trying to get in? The only polite thing was to ignore the uncanny energy. A lifetime later, it is clear to me, or at least less murky. I understand. Earl, as a harbinger from an undiscovered land. White gloves and can of polish. Courtesy. Don't fall down now, he'd admonish me. Why should I fall? I wondered. I was 5, 6, 7. I was agile and alive. I roller skated up and down outside Grant's tomb or on Riverside Drive. It was the old ladies, these were the 50s, teetering along on their high heels, hatted and gloved, with seams in their stockings, and with glassy-eyed fox furs draped over their massive chests, who might fall down, not me. Was it because it would have been rude to warn them that Earl kept warning me? Mortality has caught up with those ladies and with him. Rattled their doorknobs, it was time. Gone in. That lobby was so cold in wintertime. I still remember the stiff wind off the river, so strong that neither Earl nor any tenant could shut the outer door at all. Eventually, Earl, everyone will fall. And now from the fiction section, a short story entitled The Frog King, by Garth Greenwell. It was too early for there to be so much light, so that when I woke, my first thought was of snow. We had pulled the drapes before sleeping, but they did almost nothing to darken the room. The snow caught scraps from street lamps and neon and cast them back up. It was bright enough to see R, still sleeping beside me, cocooned in the blanket I had bought after the first night we spent together, when I woke shivering to find him bound tight in the comforter we were sharing, swaddled beside me. He repeated the word all day, apropos of nothing, swaddled, swaddled. He had never heard it before. The sound of it made him laugh. He would sleep for hours still. If I let him, he would sleep the whole day. He loved to sleep in a way I didn't, sliding into it at every chance. It was like his native element, whereas almost always I slept poorly, uneasily. I woke finally with a sense of relief. He complained if I woke him. I'm on holidays, he would say, let me sleep, but he complained more if I let him sleep too long. We only had 10 days together, his winter vacation, which he had decided to spend in Sofia, while everyone else he knew went home. Mornings were my time to work, to spend with my books and my writing, my time to be alone. I would get up soon, but for now I kept looking at him, his face bearded and dark, smoothed out by sleep. It was all I could do not to touch it, as I did often when he was awake, cupping his cheek in my palm or reaching around the curve of his skull. He had shaved his head at the end of the semester. I liked to run my hand round and round it until he ducked and told me to stop, annoyed but laughing too. Even annoyance was part of the pleasure we took in each other. We were that early in love. I was still groggy with sleep when I turned into the main room, and I stood uncomprehending for a moment before I realized that R had rearranged things in the night. He had moved the table to the middle of the room and had placed my winter boots on top of it, beside the little tree we had bought earlier that week. Sticking up from the boots were packages wrapped in newspaper, his Christmas gifts for me. He must have hidden them somewhere after he arrived. He must have got out of bed in the night, careful not to wake me. He must have been quiet as he moved the furniture. I caught my breath at it. I felt a weird pressure and heat climb in my throat. I felt like my heart would burst. Those were the words for it, the hackneyed phrase, and I was grateful for them. They were a container for what I felt, proof of its commonness. I was grateful for that, too, the commonness of my feeling. I felt some stubborn strangeness in my ease. I felt like part of the human race. He had seen snow for the first time that winter, and he loved to be out in it, to stand with his arms outstretched as it fell, his mouth open to the sky. We went out that afternoon, the snow already tracked through, but still lovely. The streets were quiet for the holiday. All the shops were closed. We were wearing the scarves I had found when I opened the presents under the tree, which were long and knit in the same pattern, one yellow and one blue. We wouldn't ever be boyfriends who wore the same clothes, R said. But one shared thing was acceptable. Having one shared thing was nice. We didn't go far. Just halfway down the block, where I whistled, a short upward swoop, I repeated three times. The usual signal. She might not be here, I had said. She isn't always. She goes other places, or maybe somebody takes her in. But she came quickly enough from her usual spot around the back of the building. She was beautiful, in her way, tawny and medium-sized, like most of Sophia's street dogs, too skinny and with mange along one side. She was happy to see us, I thought, happy as she always was to get attention. Though she lacked the confidence of some of the other dogs, she stayed close to the wall, wagging her tail, but not coming too near at first. Even when she let us pet her, she tried to keep her distance, cringing in a sidling motion that brought her body within our reach but kept her head angled away, a mixture of eagerness and fear. Somebody had taught her that, I thought. Somebody had beaten her, or many people had. But not in this neighborhood. Here everyone was kind to her. She was sort of a communal pet. She lost some of her shyness when R drew the packet of treats out of his coat pocket, clumsy in his mittens, which he had to take off before he could tear open the packet and pull out one of the strips of leathery meat. She started whining when she saw it, prancing closer, and he crooned her name, Liliana. Although that didn't mean anything to her. It was just a name he had invented. It suited her, he thought. Elatuka, he said, a phrase I had taught him. Come here. And he held out the treat so that she could take it, which she did by stretching her neck and pulling back her lips, taking hold of it with her front teeth like a deer plucking a leaf. He had bought the treats the night before when we were getting supplies for the next day. She should have Christmas dinner, too, he said. She let us pet her more vigorously, and then finally coming close, even pressing her side against his legs as she begged for a second piece, which he gave her. Though that was all for today, he told her. There would be more tomorrow. She seemed to accept this. She didn't keep begging once we turned away, as most dogs would have, I thought. She disappeared behind the building again to whatever shelter she had found. We found the tree by chance one late afternoon. We were in a part of town I'd never seen before, on the other side of the city center, looking for a German supermarket, a chain that was popular in Western Europe, but that had only the single store in Sofia. It was less a store than a warehouse, really. There weren't shelves, but huge bins people pawed through, so that everything was mixed together. A dozen kinds of chocolate bar in one bin, toothpaste and shaving cream in another. The chain had its own brand of food, and R was craving something from his life in Lisbon, a frozen lasagna. And when we found it in an oversized freezer case, he clutched it to his chest with happiness. It was a long walk from the store to the metro, longer because the sidewalks were caked with ice. R scolded me as we walked, telling me to take my hands out of my pockets, to keep them free in case I slipped, as, for whatever reason, I did often enough. If it had been night, he would have passed his arm through mine to keep me upright. R saw the trees first, in the window of a little shop that was full of Christmas decorations. Even from outside, you could see how cheap they were, all metal wire and plastic bristles. But R insisted that we needed one, and ornaments, a box of lights. "I want to have a real Christmas," he said. It was maybe 3 feet tall. It hardly weighed anything, but it was cumbersome. I held it in both arms like a child as we walked. I felt a little ridiculous sitting with it on the train, but R seemed proud. He kept one arm around it to hold it steady on the seat between us. When we got home, he wanted to trim the tree right away, and he opened the box of tinsel to find that it was far too large. We hadn't been paying attention. It was meant for a much bigger tree. He laughed as he wrapped it again and again around the branches. "She was swaddled now," he said. "It would keep her warm." "Her," I repeated back to him, inquisitive, mocking him a little. And this gave him an idea. She needed a name, he said, and he decided to call her Madeline. I don't have any idea where it came from, but he loved to say it. He liked to give things names. I think it was a way of laying claim to them, and he called out to her every time he passed, almost singing it, "Madeline, Madeline." He saved the box of ornaments for Christmas Eve, little glass balls we hung from hooks on the branches, tucked among the tinsel. We knelt to arrange them, and when we finished, R sat back on his heels. "Isn't she beautiful?" he said, taking my hand in his. But he answered the question himself. "She is, isn't she? I think she's beautiful." We went to Bologna because it was the cheapest place we could fly. There were tickets for 40 euros, a price I could afford. We packed a single carry-on each. Anything else would have meant a fee, and rode in a cab to the airport's old terminal, which the budget airlines used. It was my first time leaving the country. During breaks, when the other American teachers left for places near or far, Istanbul, Tangier, St. Petersburg, I stayed behind. "I didn't want to travel," I said. "I wanted to be settled in a single place." I studied Bulgarian, I read, I wandered the streets downtown. But I did want to travel with R, to leave Sofia, where even when his friends were gone there was a pressure of secrecy, where it was too dangerous to hold hands in the streets, to kiss in public, however chastely, where everywhere we had to keep a casual distance. I wanted to be with him in a place where we could be freer with each other, a place in the West. It was my gift to him, a getaway, a bit of romance. We arrived at the airport early enough to be first in line for the unassigned seats and sat in the front row where there was extra room for our legs. Even so, my knees almost touched those of the single attendant who sat facing us, strapped into her fold-out seat. She spoke English with an accent I couldn't place, not Bulgarian, but something Eastern European, and she smiled slightly, kindly, I thought. When the plane started down the runway, thrusting us all back, and R moved his hand to cover mine, where it lay on my knee. We booked the cheapest hotel, too, a chain a good way from the city center, with a bus stop outside for getting to town. We arrived too late for any exploring. We'd have to wait until morning to see the city. It was hard not to feel depressed by our room, which had the corporate airlessness of such places, comfort sterilized of any human touch. It was on the second floor, overlooking the parking lot. "It's not exactly a dream of Italy," I said, meaning it as an apology. But R laughed. He drew the curtain across the glass and pulled me to the bed. "Who cares about the view?" he said. "The bed is nice. That's all that matters. You should care about the bed." And then we were both laughing, one on top of the other. The hotel's one luxury was the breakfast we found the next morning, a buffet of eggs and sliced meats, yogurt and fruit, a table overloaded with cakes and tarts. It was still early. We had set our alarms. We wanted the whole day for the city, and I needed coffee first, which meant a complicated machine with a digital screen and then waiting for the paper cup to fill. When I turned back, I saw that R had covered our table with little plates, a sample from each of the suites. He hadn't left any room for me. I stood for a moment while he tried to clear a space for my coffee, shifting the plates around until one almost tipped onto the floor. He caught it just in time. I made a little noise, exasperated and amused, and he looked up at me and shrugged. He would take a single bite from each plate and then move it to one side or the other, sorting out the things he liked. I watched him for a while, and then, "Really?" I said, my tone half question, half disbelief, making a gesture that took in the table with its plates, the room, the other people eating. He shrugged again, glancing around at the assortment of other travelers, businessmen mostly, and a few couples. "Who cares?" he said, using his fork to dig into another piece of something. "They don't know me. We'll never see them again. Why should I care what they think?" I remembered this later, waiting for the bus that would take us to town. We were the only people in the little shelter at the top, huddling together against the wind, which was sharper than I had expected. It wasn't very cold, but it was cold enough for our coats, for the scarves we had draped around each other before heading out. And then R stepped up onto the bench. He grabbed my shoulders and turned me to face him. "Now, I'm the taller one," he said, and bent down to kiss me. Not a chest kiss. He gripped my hair and tilted my head further back to probe my mouth with his tongue. I tried to pull away, laughing. It was a busy road. We were in full view of the passing cars. But he held me tight, kissing me with urgency, until I realized that exposure was the point, that he wanted to show off. Here, where nobody knew him, where he could be anonymous and free, could live out an ideal of candor. The bus left us in the Piazza Maggiore, where there was a huge wooden statue in the center of the square, a cylinder painted an uneven green. The bottom half was featureless, the top carved into the torso of a frog, regal and upright, his lips drawn back in an expression at once benevolent and severe. Two arms crossed at his stomach, four long fingers hanging down from each. Above the half-lidded eyes, there was a crown with four prongs. Cables stretched down from the statue's midsection, securing it to the pavement. Wooden barriers marked off a space around it. It would be burned. The man working at a reception told us back at the hotel when we asked. It was the tradition. The old year burned at the turn of the new. I remembered something I had seen in a movie, Fellini maybe, a stuffed witch on a pile of kindling and old furniture, the trash of the past, the promise of an uncluttered future. I wondered why we didn't do something similar in the States, where we love to pretend to start afresh, where we love to burn things down. There was nothing like it in Bulgaria either, where New Year's was celebrated at home. Families gathered in apartments, and at midnight they set off fireworks from their balconies. It had frightened me my first year, the sound ricocheting off the walls as the little bombs fell into the streets below, where everyone knew not to be. They were impassable for a good half hour. Which was the opposite of clearing away. All over the city, the explosions came down, and nobody swept them up. The wrappers and casings littered the streets until the heavy spring rains. It wasn't a traditional statue, the man told us. There was a competition for it each year. Artists submitted designs, and the winner had his work displayed there, in the center of the city, for a week before it was burned. "For us, the frog is a symbol," the man said. "It means poverty. Here in Bologna, in Italy, so it means to burn poverty. You know, The crisis is very hard here, he said. The austerity is very hard. It would be good to burn it away. He had apologized for his English, but it was very good. Less stiff than he seemed in his jacket and tie, he was young, mid-twenties, a college student in a university town. You should go, he said. It's a party. There will be music and lots of people, and you can watch the fire. It's something you should see. There was so much to see. Too much. I walked around in a daze of looking. We moved in and out of churches, crowded with paintings, huge and smoke-darkened, the ceilings crammed with color. I got tired of trying to see them. R was full of zeal. He wanted to see everything. Who knows when we'll be back, he said. The dilemma of vacations, the exhaustion of the last chance. Everything became unremarkable. Nothing moved me. It was all a blur of perfection. I wanted to get the bus back to the hotel. I wanted to rest my eyes. But just one more thing, R said, paging through the guidebook we had bought, and he led me to a small museum, a house converted after the artist who had lived in it had died. There were just a few rooms, open and uncluttered, the walls painted mercifully white. It wouldn't take long for R to make his circuit. I followed him, barely looking at the paintings, which were small and unremarkable, or remarkable only for their plainness. They were quiet and unambitious, minor, I thought, at first, still lifes, and modest landscapes. Interesting mostly for having so little to do with everything else we had seen. The painter had spent his whole life in this city, but seemed indifferent to the examples it offered, to the virtuosity and gorgeousness it prized. I found myself looking longer, looking more slowly. I let R walk on ahead. The same subject appeared again and again. Household objects, plates and bowls, not filled with flowers or fruit, but empty, set against a plain background. I stopped in front of one that showed a pitcher and cups, white and gray on a tan surface. Behind them, a blue wall. Something held me there looking. Something made me lean in to look more closely. The cups were mismatched in color and in shape. The pitcher rose oddly elongated behind them. The whole painting was eccentric, asymmetrical. There was a kind of presence in the painting, I felt. I could sense it humming at a frequency I wanted to tune myself to catch. I liked the seeming naivete in it, the way the simple figures had been simplified further, purified or idealized to geometric forms almost, but rendered bluntly, imperfectly. And the brushstrokes were imperfect too, visible, haphazard, the paint distributed unevenly, inexpertly. But that wasn't right. Really, it was striving for something ideal. That was what I felt, the frequency I wanted to catch. What I took at first for blocks of color dissolved when I leaned in, were modulated, textured, full of movement somehow. Not the movement of objects, but of light, which fell across them gently, undramatically. But that's not right either. It didn't fall across them. There weren't any shadows. I couldn't locate the light at all, or tell if the scene depicted morning or noon. It was as if the objects emanated their own light, which didn't move from one quadrant of the painting to another, as real light would, but vibrated somehow so that there was a sense of movement and stillness at once. There was a promise in it, I felt. I mean a promise for me, a claim about what life could be. Venice was 2 hours away by train. Another unmissable chance. We wouldn't stay the night. The hotel in Bologna was already paid for. We would spend a few hours exploring and then come back. On the train, I stared at the fields we passed, which were laid out neatly. In lines, I realized, I had never seen in Bulgaria. The fields alongside the train, from Sofia to the coast, were shaggy, inexactly drawn, like the fields I remembered from my childhood, my family's fields in Kentucky. Nothing like this clean geometry, I stared at them, hypnotized, and turned away only when I felt R's hand on my ankle, calling me back. We were facing each other. I had my foot on the empty seat beside him, and he hooked his fingers underneath the cuff of my jeans and was stroking me softly, privately, not looking up from his book. But I knew he wasn't reading. He was smiling just slightly, his eyes on the page. He was basking in how I looked at him. We had no plans in Venice, had done no research. But it didn't matter. Just to be there was enough, amid the capillary water and sinking stone. There was a kind of uniform beauty to everything, a blanket wonder. Every corner we turned made R gasp. Every church we stepped into, every statue with its marble frothed up like surf, like the involutions of thought. "Damn these people," R whispered as we stared at a painted ceiling. "Damn them for getting to live in a place like this." He was smiling when I glanced at him, but I knew he meant it, or half meant it. He often said that he was born in the wrong place. Portugal, Algarve, the Azores, Lisbon. It should have all been different. His life was damned. Somehow I could bring him back out of these moods. I could kiss him and say he had a new life now, his life with me. Who knew where we'd end up? In Europe or America? Who knew what adventures we'd have? And sometimes he pushed me away or turned his face from mine. "We don't get to choose anything," he'd say then. "We think we do, but it's an illusion. We're insects. We get stepped on, or we don't. That's all." When he talked like this, there was nothing I could do. Anything I did made it worse. Whether I got angry or sad or tried to make him feel my own happiness, the happiness I felt so often just looking at him as he slept or read or stared into the screen of his laptop. It was an immovable force, this mood that descended on him sometimes, and I worried that it was descending on him now, that it would darken the rest of our day. But it didn't descend. When we left the church and turned blindly around the next corner, he pulled me into a little alcove and kissed me, his hands on the sides of my face. "I can't believe I'm here," he said. "It's like a movie. I'm in Venice with my American boyfriend." And he laughed. My sister would be so jealous. She's always wanted an American boyfriend, and I got one first. And then he was off again, dragging me by the hand behind him. He did this repeatedly, pulling me into doorways and alleys to kiss me, always somewhere a little apart, though we were still noticed. People passing would stare at us or look decidedly away. One heavy old man scowled. A young couple laughed, which I minded more. R seemed not to notice, but I noticed. It was a weird reversal. He was the one that was more open here, and I was hyper-aware, feeling the reflexes of fear, though I wasn't afraid. I didn't think I was afraid. Our only principle was to stay away from the crowds of other tourists who moved in migratory flocks, following the little pennant or flag the guides all held above their heads, tiny, bright triangles on long stems. It meant not seeing the important things, but I didn't care. I'd never cared about important things. Their edges were rubbed smooth by too much looking. There was nothing for my attention to catch on in them. I liked the dark streets we turned into better, the narrow paths beside the canals. Even here there were restaurants and shops. Nowhere on that island is indifferent to tourists. Money from elsewhere is the blood of the place. We stopped in the footbridges and looked at the boats bundled up on either side of the canals, trussed in canvas, their wooden sides deep shades of blue and green, their reflections darker shadows in the water. It wasn't late, but it was getting dark already, at least where we were. The sun had abandoned the narrow alleys to an afternoon dusk. We had left the grand palazzos behind, the churches. Where we were now, there were plastic shopping bags filled with trash beside the doors. "This is where the people live," R said, a trick of English making him sound like a revolutionary. Then he laughed and pointed ahead at a bright yellow bag with the letters B-I-L-L-A on it, its red handles tied off in a bow. It was the store we went to all the time in Middeldost, our neighborhood store. I knew it was a part of a big chain, that you could find them everywhere in Europe, but still it felt like a bit of good fortune to stumble across it here. R pulled out his guidebook then, with its useless maps. He was afraid we would lose the light before we saw San Marco. He started walking more quickly while I hung back, protesting. It didn't matter. Everything was beautiful. Everything was something we hadn't seen before and wouldn't see again. But he insisted, increasingly frustrated as the map refused to align with the streets we walked. He was better with maps than I was, but not by much. He got annoyed with me for walking too slowly and stopping too often, but I wanted to take photos of everything. The buildings, the canals, the laundry hung out in the damp air to dry. The mask shop with its window of carnival grotesques, backlit through the metal grill that had been pulled down. R was growing frantic in a way I didn't understand. "We would lose the light," he kept saying, as though he were an artist imagining a scene. "I want to see it before we lose the light." So I put away my camera and walked more quickly. I kept my eyes on R so that I wouldn't be distracted by anything else. And he did it. He found it, finally. By luck, mostly, I think. Suddenly we turned and it opened out before us, after the cramped alleys, the expanse of the square, beyond it, the horizon of water. R turned to me, smiling. And surely it wasn't at that moment that the bells began to ring. It's a trick of memory to stage it that way, but it is how I remember it. The birds flying up, everyone turning to the campanile, as we did, its top still bright, as it caught the last of the sun. Merchants were walking through the crowds, hawking toys for children, spinning tops that burst into LED color as they helicoptered up. All that was new there was evanescent, the toys, the tourists, R, and I. All that was lasting was old, worn dull with looking, though still I wondered to look at it. The centuries, old basilica, the bells, the gold lion on its pedestal, the sea that would swallow it, and everywhere also the books I had read. So that, look, there, I could almost convince myself of it. Aschenbach stepping from uncertain water to stone. I had a mind full of useless things, I had always thought, or useless since graduate school, where they had been a kind of currency. The old stories and stray facts that were all that remained of the years in which I wanted to be a scholar. The books that I read. But in the churches of Venice, I found a use for them. I could read the paintings for R. Or not the paintings, but the stories he told. Joseph of Arimathea, Mary and Martha, Sebastian nursing his arrows. In churches in Bulgaria, the paintings were more or less mute to me. But here they made a story I could read, and as I told it to him, I saw the pleasure R took in it, the way he looked at me and then at the painting. I loved to see it. "I have a crush on teacher," he said, whispering. It made me smile, this smile that meant happiness. His whole face beaming, turning toward the painting now, though I knew the smile was for me. Later, back in Bologna, where we arrived on the last train after all the restaurants had closed. We ate shrink-wrapped sandwiches and chocolate, shared a little bottle of Prosecco, all of it from a 24-hour shop near the station. He asked me to tell him more. It didn't matter what. "Tell me a story," he said, stretched out in bed, as I lay beside him, running my hands across his chest and stomach. "Tell me another story." I woke a few hours later, too hot, stifling in the bedclothes. I switched on the lamp beside the bed. R slept so deeply, I never had to worry about waking him on the nights I couldn't sleep, when I spent hours beside him reading or writing. But this time he did wake, or half wake, as I lay with a book propped on my stomach. He turned toward me and linked his arm through mine before settling back into sleep, his face pressed against my shoulder. I looked at him for a long moment before going back to my book. They could make a whole life, I thought, surprised to think it. These moments, that filled me with sweetness, that had changed the texture of existence for me. I had never thought anything like it before. I wanted to make him laugh at first. I meant it almost as a joke. We needed to laugh. It had been hard to return to Sofia after our days in Italy. More snow had fallen, but by the time we arrived, the city had turned gray again. The holidays were over. The cars kicked black sludge from their tires, and now it was his last night in my apartment. In the morning, he would gather his things and go back to Dostinsky Grad. His friends would arrive in the afternoon. We would return to our uncertain arrangements, emails, and dates that he might break at the last minute or without any notice at all. Those were the conditions. They were non-negotiable. He hated it, he said. He didn't want to go back to hiding. And throughout the day, his dread had increased and darkened, coloring everything until by nighttime he could barely speak. He had folded in on himself as he did sometimes. It was hard for me to reach him, to have any effect on him at all. We watched a movie, side by side on the couch. I don't remember what it was, something lighthearted, romantic, though he hardly laughed. We never really watched movies together. It was always a pretense. We would kiss and touch each other and then forget the movie. But now it was all I could do to get him to kiss me back. Finally, he let me pull him up from the couch. I folded the computer shut and led him, half-resisting, into the bedroom. And I said the words that somehow became more real with repetition. Usually words wear out the more you use them. They become featureless, rote. And more than any others, this is true of the words I repeated to R. Even in our relationship that was still so new, they had lost most of their flavor. I remembered the fear that I had felt the first time I spoke them to him, weeks before, when they had all their force. I had been terrified, really. Not so much that they wouldn't be answered. They weren't. It would be days before he repeated them. As that they would scare him away, that he would startle like the wild thing I sometimes felt he was. But now we said them often, when we left each other and were reunited, even if it was only a room we left, only minutes we were separated. But repeating the words now didn't dull them. It called them to attention somehow, to service. It restored them so that they became difficult to say again. I was surprised to see the tears in his face, two lines that fell toward his ears. He hadn't wiped them away. He didn't try to hide them when I moved his arm, or tried only by turning his face slightly, as if he didn't want to meet my gaze. Though his eyes were shut, there was no gaze to meet. I paused a moment, wanting to speak, to ask him what they were for, his tears. But I knew what they were for, and so I hung over him a moment before I continued kissing him, the lines of his jaw, his chin, the cheek and lips, which didn't answer mine, which suffered themselves to be kissed, his ears, the tracks of his tears, his eyes. It was all kind of a blason of him, of his body. I love you, I whispered again and again to him. And then when I had laid the last line across his forehead, a garland, I thought, I had garlanded him. You are the most beautiful, I said to him. You are my beautiful boy. And he reached his arms up and pulled me down on top of him, clutching me tightly. You are, he whispered to me. You are. You are. They had used some kind of accelerant. They must have, so that when the three children touched their torches to it, angling their bodies away, keeping the greatest distance between themselves and the fire, the flames leapt up the wood. From the base to the ridiculous crown, the whole frog blazed up. And with it, there was a huge explosion of sound, air horns and rattlers and little handbells children jingled, and above them all, human voices, the crowd cheering both the fire and the new year which had just struck. There were hundreds of people in the square, pressed tight near the wooden barricades that held them back from the fire, but thinner near the edges, where we were. There was space here for people to toast one another with wine in plastic cups or little glass bottles like those R had brought for us, Prosecco with a twist-off cap. After we drank, I leaned toward him and cupped his face in my palm, and we kissed. I moved my mouth in a way he liked, kissing first his upper lip and then his lower lip, before I drew away, hanging my arm around his shoulder. And then, as the statue burned, it was huge, it would take a long time to burn, there was another sound, a salute of drums and a burst of guitars, and then the far corner of the square lit up with floodlights, and there was a new shout from the crowd as it shifted toward the platform where the band had begun to play. Four skinny boys bent over their instruments. There was a keyboard as well as the guitars and drums. It was an American sound, I thought, which contrasted with the stone buildings around us, with the pagan fire. R and I didn't move as the crowd thinned further. We wouldn't stay. It was cold, and the band wasn't very good. We would watch the fire a little longer, and then go back to the hotel. R pulled away from me suddenly, reached into his coat pocket, taking from it the packet of raisins he had bought earlier with the wine. "I almost forgot," he said. "It's almost too late." He handed me his bottle, took off one of his mittens so that he could open the packet. "Give me your hand," he said. So I put the bottles on the ground and held it out to him, taking my glove off as he asked, and he counted out 12 raisins, placing them in my palm in a single line from my wrist to the tip of my third finger, and then counting another 12 for himself. It was the Portuguese tradition, he had told me, a raisin for each month of the year that had passed, a wish for each month of the year to come. He looked at me and smiled. He said, "Feliz año," and we kissed again. He ate his all at once, tossing them in his mouth and putting his mitten back on before he leaned down for his bottle and turned to watch the fire. But I didn't watch the fire. I kept my eyes on him, though it was cold, and I wanted to be back in the hotel with him in the warmth of our bed. I took my time. I put the raisins in my mouth one by one, thinking a wish for each, though all my wishes were the same wish. This story was edited slightly for this broadcast. And now from the On Television section, a review entitled From Scratch, The Home-Cooked Pleasures of Please Like Me by Emily Nussbaum. In the second season of the Australian series Please Like Me, our millennial hero Josh Thomas, the show's creator, visits his mom, Rose, at a psychiatric hospital, carrying a gift box of bonbons. In the cafeteria, he's drawn into a high-stakes competition for the last piece of candy as patients vie to tell the most outlandish first sex story in a wave of bubbly one-upmanship. Finally, they turn to the silent Hannah, played by Hannah Gadsby, who is best known to American audiences from her Netflix special, Nanette. "I was raped," she says. The table panics. "Oh, Hannah, I'm really sorry," Josh says. "If Mom had known, I'm sure she wouldn't have asked." "No, I don't mind," Hannah deadpans. "I just knew, the whole time you were talking, I was going to get the chocolate." It's a typical sequence for Please Like Me, a gorgeously made, psychologically observant comedy that lets vulnerable people own their jokes. Rude and gentle, often simultaneously, it's part of that nimble TV genre, sometimes called tromedy, sometimes dramedy, and how I wish there were a better name for it, which tends to focus on youngish, single persons adrift. In this case, the drifter is Josh, a persnickety, self-abnegating student living in Melbourne. In the pilot, Josh kisses a boy for the first time and begins, in an endearingly diffident style, life as a gay man. "I think I'll miss vaginas," he later tells his straight best friend Tom. "You know, so nifty." In the episode with the kiss, Josh learns that Rose has attempted suicide. The show continues in this way, bridging joy and tragedy, a blend unusually true to life. When Please Like Me debuted in 2013, it was sometimes pitched, reductively, but understandably, as, quote, the gay girls, end quote. It also bears some family resemblance to Tig Notaro's One Mississippi and Jill Soloway's Transparent, as well as to more recent projects such as the lovely Deaf Culture series This Close on Sundance, Desiree Akhaven's terrific spiky new series The Bisexual on Hulu, and the Irish codependent friends show Can't Cope, Won't Cope on Netflix. These shows have become a thriving mode of intimate, quasi-auteurist television, making they're also one of the rare places you find diverse portraits of gay life. Their specificity is their charm, as with Dinette, a sleepy gem on Vimeo, set in Clinton Hill, Brooklyn, or the very funny The Gay and Wondrous Life of Caleb Gallo, available on YouTube. In older ratings models, shows like this, niche, improvisational in style, with marginalized characters at their center, might never get made. On streaming, the best of them can gain an appreciative audience years later. Please Like Me, which ran in the U.S., largely unheralded on the now-defunct Pivot, is thankfully available now on Hulu. 4 seasons, 32 episodes with a satisfying, appropriately bittersweet ending. As I caught up on Thomas's series, it became my answer to a common question. What's a show that will comfort me, but not make me feel more miserable? For a series with so many unhappy characters, Please Like Me is a surprisingly joyful watch. Still, what makes the show unique and lends it a rare toughness is the bond between Josh and Rose, who is played with bravura, fragility by Deborah Lawrence. Rose, mouthy, brash, unpredictable, is hard to deal with, but you root for her as she tries various medications, struggles with relationships, and comes to terms with her diagnosis as bipolar. Josh loves his mother deeply. He also views her as a burden. The show is refreshingly uncorny about subjects like this. As humane as it is, Please Like Me has none of the bullying positivity of more formulaic issue TV. It allows for the rough fact that not everything can be fixed. That might sound depressing. It's not. It's a relief. The show's joyfulness is due as much to its confident aesthetic sensuousness as to its subject matter. Each episode is named for a food-related subject. Josh is a passionate, if slapdash, home chef raising chickens in his backyard. There's music throughout, including many sing-alongs. Like Josh in his kitchen, the show continually turns scraps of dialogue, of plot, into something hearty. During a Christmas episode, the table unites in faith in the power of gravy. "It's like the heart of a god guide dog," Tom exclaims. Minor characters are often as vivid as central ones. Along with the depressive Hannah, who moves in with Rose, the ensemble includes Josh's stoical dad, Alan, and his new girlfriend, May, Josh's high school girlfriend, the equally adrift Claire, and his hangdog friend, Tom, played by Thomas's own best friend, Tom Ward. The show's treatment of Josh's sexual adventures, like its treatment of mental illness, is idiosyncratic and unsentimental, romantic without dipping into formula. In the first season, Josh comes out with very little struggle. He has his share of issues, a melancholic squeamishness, a longing for affection that is undermined by flashes of coldness, but they're particular to him. Finding equilibrium with his parents, one of whom is essentially paying him to help take care of the other, often feels like the bigger crisis. At the same time, the show pushes back at homophobia, subtly without Kant, by celebrating gentleness, candor, and vulnerability, the ebb and flow of emotion among people who mean well. Once in a while, it does tie these questions directly to queerness. In Simple Carbohydrates, Josh is dating Arnold, played by Keegan-Joyce, a clinically anxious young man who had a stay at Rose's hospital. When Alan crashes Josh's party in a distressed state, the group falls into an odd role play as a way of distracting him. Josh insists that Alan act the role of Arnold's bigoted dad so that Arnold can practice coming out. Okay, Alan says stiffly, trying to get in character as a cartoon ideal of a tolerant father. Well, that's great news. Thanks for telling me. Maybe on the weekend you can take me to the shops and teach me to dress better. Sure thing, pal, Arnold replies, tightly and brightly. Josh frowns and says, I didn't like it. No, I didn't like it, not one bit. Arnold has to sing, Josh maintains. In fact, he has to sing in the emotional, tellingly effeminate way that Arnold's father hated when his son was in the school choir. Everyone involved, Tom is there too, even Claire is on Skype, is on tenderhooks. But eventually, Arnold stands and sings, and as he performs an a cappella version of Sia's Chandelier, Josh directs his father how to react. Sit, Grumpy, he tells him, before ushering him into the living room. And then, as the song changes, gradually change your mind. In a small masterpiece of performance, as Arnold sings, his voice rising and falling in this song about alcoholism, 1, 2, 3, or 1, 2, 3, drink. Alan at first listens. And then as the camera moves closer, we see his eyes soften. We watch him, as Arnold's father, absorb the beauty, the feminine loveliness of his son's voice. We're watching everyone watch him, too, witnessing the miracle, the performance of family love becoming real behind the mask of another man, as Alan makes the leap from accepting his gay child to adoring him, seeing him fully. That's my boy, he tells Arnold as Josh and his friends tear up. That's my son. It's a lovely and intuitive sequence. It feels endlessly replayable, like a perfect pop song. The show is full of such moments, conversations that play like music. One small delight to binge-watching the series is seeing every iteration of the opening credits, which are set to the severely groovy I'll Be Fine by Clary Brown and the Bangin' Raquettes. Oh, the good Lord knows it. I left better behind. I'll be fine, Brown croons, over a sequence that continually changes from one meal to another. Mostly, Josh and his friends dance as they chop and fry. When Rose enters the hospital, the song plays over a sequence of patients getting pills from the nurses. Once it's sung by a drag queen at a bar. In a remarkable episode called Scroggin, in which Josh and his mother go camping in Tasmania, Rose sings it solo during their hike. These moments make a small show feel capacious, a welcoming place in which to change your mind. But we have some time left, so we'll read another poem. This one, entitled The Poem Said, by Michael Dickman. The poem said that sunlight back there is the only thing I like. Let's pour it back into starter beds or leave it on the sill for neighbors or for later, a grassy smell in the kitchen. Lidocaine floats, the fringed tulips in a crease, and that's the morning. There's so much to look forward to, big bowls of cereal, a tonal shift in the fertilizer. Later, automatic ramen and a Coke. You can start anywhere, it doesn't really matter. Flowers on the table, breathe sugar, the skylight, and the dosage doesn't. And now for some cartoons. The first one depicts an observatory with a huge telescope and a scientist peering up into the telescope with his white coat on. Behind him is an astronaut holding his astronaut's helmet in his hand. And the scientist says, "Good news, I see your keys next to the flag. In the next cartoon, we see a depiction of a outdoor market, and we have a couple, a man and a woman, speaking to another woman. The man has a baby in his arms, and his wife has a bag of flowers, and the lady is pushing a stroller with a baby in it. And the man's wife says to the other woman, "We named her Alexa, thinking forward to when she'll be taking care of us." In the next cartoon, we see a man kneeling, holding the hand of a woman standing outside under a starry sky. In his hand, he has a box with a ring opened up. He's looking at her. She's looking down at him. And he says, "Okay, how about I throw in a necklace, too?" Finally, we see an office. On the wall of the office, a photograph of the New York Review of Books, Best of 2018. There's a bearded man sitting on one side of the desk. On the other side is a dog with glasses. He has a manuscript in his hands, and he says, "Glenn, I'm not just your editor. I'm also your best friend. And I'm telling you, lose the cat." Well, we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast and all previous New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.